We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Xinjiang in western China is home to a unique population of Chinese Muslims. Now, the Chinese government maintains that these people, the Uyghurs, are part of the great family of the Chinese nation. That's the kind of language they use. However, many Uyghurs believe that they are part of a distinct Uyghur nation with their own homeland, history, and culture. And in fact, some believe that their homeland, Xinjiang, should be independent. This morning on Focus, we'll be talking about the Uyghurs and their long struggle for autonomy. And our guest for the program is Gardner Bovington from Indiana University at Bloomington, where he is on the faculty of East Asian Languages and Cultures. He's associate professor there. And he is a scholar who has done work on the politics and history of modern Xinjiang, as well as nationalism and ethnic conflict. And he is the author of a recently published book, probably one of the few resources for people who are interested in finding out more and learning more about the Uyghurs. His book is titled The Uyghurs, Strangers in Their Own Land, and it's published by the Columbia University Press. So certainly that's something that you can find in the bookstore if you'd like to take a look at it. And questions are welcome, too. We hope people will try to be brief so we can keep our program moving along and keep your question focused on our topic. But that if you can do that, your questions are welcome. Here are the numbers. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, so no matter where you're listening, if it would be a long-distance call, use that, 800-222-9455. And you may also send along your questions by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. So any way you do it, your input here is certainly welcome. And Professor Bovington, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. Just some basic things I think we want to talk about here at the outset, and then I'm sure we'll come back and maybe talk about some of these things in greater detail. But I think it's probably good to begin with a point that you make early on in the introduction to the book, and that is, until fairly recently, few people had ever heard of the Uyghurs, and fewer still, as you write, knew that these people living in Western China were Muslim, but that all really changed with 9/11.
Yes, that's right. And you haven't exactly put the question this way, but if we wanted to ask why few people had heard of Uyghurs, the simplest answer probably is that most people think of China as a largely homogeneous place. The Han Chinese population, which constitute the vast majority, are well known. And if people are aware of a minority group, as the Chinese Communist Party calls them, in China, they're aware of the Tibetans because of the good offices of the Dalai Lama and the excellent network of cultural and political organizations around the world keeping people aware of them, whereas there had for a long time been no such organization or leader for Uyghurs. And after 9/11, as you've noted, the circumstances changed, and the Chinese government used the kind of global shock at what had just happened to publicize something it had long been concerned about but actually not cared to make public, worrying that it might be misinterpreted, was that there was this separatist movement of some duration in the Northwest, and that the separatists were themselves Muslims, and therefore Beijing judged that it could use the aftermath of 9/11 advantageously to publicize this and gain global support.
And there, I think, is another very important point you want to make at the beginning, and another that you do make, and that is the unfortunate consequences of the way in which most people became aware of the existence of the Uyghurs and started to learn something about Xinjiang, and that is that people might see them as a potential threat and view them through the same lens that they view Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
And the point that you want to make is here, well, there's almost no Uyghurs have any connection with Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. And further, that your argument is that resistance to the Chinese, this is not an Islamic movement. This is a nationalist movement.
Yes. Yes. I think that's a very accurate summary of my argument. You did a much better job than I did.
Well, to start out and again be a little bit brief, and I'm sure we can talk more about how this developed. But so if we ask the question, well, as far as the Chinese government is concerned, what is its official position regarding the Uyghurs and their place in modern China?
The official Chinese position is that Uyghurs are one of 56 ethno-national groups. The Chinese use the term Minzu, and it doesn't play well in the air, but I seldom translate the term because it's a kind of an iffy term. It's not really clear whether one should translate it ethnic group or whether one should translate it nation. And the reason that that unclarity is important is that in the Anglophone world, when we use ethnic group, we're talking about a group that's unquestionably part of an existing state, and we talk about nation, we're talking about something that is already, or at least potentially could be, the proprietor of a state of its own. So the official Chinese position is that Uyghurs are one of these 56 groups in China, called a Minzu, but also part of an umbrella Minzu called the Chinese Nation. And they're there alongside Tibetans and Han Chinese and many other groups that are probably less known. And as you nicely summarized in the beginning, the Chinese government says that they are one in a great family of ethno-national groups, or Minzu, in China. They always were, and they always will be.
And the Chinese, as far as they look at Xinjiang, that is Beijing, the Chinese government looks at Xinjiang, they don't talk of it as one state. They've also divided it up into a number of other smaller regions within that region.
You mean all of China?
Well, I'm thinking of the, and maybe I misunderstood, but I'm thinking about Xinjiang itself. That what the Chinese have done is they've divided it into a number of different regions that they see as somewhat distinct.
Yes. Okay. I'm sorry, I didn't initially understand where you were going with that.
Yeah.
Yes, as I argue in one of the chapters, the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region is one of five provincial-level autonomous entities in China, autonomous being an official term, not an accurate depiction of political realities. And each of those autonomous regions at the provincial level is named for particular groups. So Tibet is actually officially the Tibetan Autonomous Region, and so forth. But what what Beijing did when it set up Xinjiang as an autonomous region is it began by setting up smaller units within it, and this is what you were talking about, each of them an autonomous unit at the sub-provincial level, and each of them assigned to another group. So within the Uyghur Autonomous Region, there are smaller Kazakh Autonomous Prefecture, Kyrgyz Autonomous Prefecture, Mongol Autonomous Prefecture, and so forth. And in this way, as I say, they parcelized this hypothetically unitary Uyghur Autonomous Region into a number of smaller units.
And clearly that would seem to be a strategy to keep those people as divided as possible, to lessen the potential for them all getting together and posing a threat to the central government by being one bigger, more organized entity.
Absolutely. And it was very cleverly done.
Yeah. And no doubt as far as the government is concerned, as Beijing is concerned, they will argue that their involvement in Xinjiang has been good for the region and been good for the people there, and that I'm sure they would say that Xinjiang and the people who live there are better off for the involvement of China there. And it's the same kind of argument they make for Tibet.
Yes, absolutely. They would make that exact argument, and they frequently do.
Well, if you turn this now to the other side and to ask the question how the Uyghur people feel about this idea that there is this big Chinese family and they're part of it, how do they feel about that?
Well, it's a very good question, and here we run into a difficulty that begins with the first word in the title of my book. Left to my own devices, I would not have called the book The Uyghurs, because I don't want to suggest that I am describing in this book all of the people and the people as a unit. I know individual Uyghurs, and I've been studying this place and its people for a very long time. So in answering your question, I can't answer directly and say this is what all the Uyghurs want. I can talk about Uyghurs I've known and the extensive studies I've done. And in sum, what I would say is there's very clear evidence that a majority of Uyghurs are dissatisfied with the way Xinjiang is governed now. And the simplest way of explaining that is that while autonomous in name, Xinjiang is not autonomous in fact. Uyghurs do not, in fact, wield substantial political authority and have substantial latitude to govern the place as they see fit. And there are plenty of other aspects of the problem that we could go into, but that, in sum, is the major problem that most Uyghurs have. I could add that it's very clear that a certain number of Uyghurs, and nobody knows for sure how many, are so dissatisfied that they believe the only solution to their dissatisfaction is to establish an independent state. Mm-hmm. And those are the ones that China is particularly concerned about.
Well, it certainly seems to be the case that that many Uyghurs, at least, when they hear the Chinese talking about the great Chinese family, they say, well, the fact of the matter is that Xinjiang is a colony. And China is an imperial power, and that is something, that kind of relationship is something that certainly goes back before the creation of the People's Republic. It goes all the way back to the Qing, and I'm sure that people there in Xinjiang would say, well, you can talk all day about how we're one big family, but the fact of the matter is it's not like that, and it certainly hasn't been like that for hundreds of years, and they might say that it hasn't been like that for thousands of years.
Yes, absolutely right. And you've already pointed up something very important about sort of popular Uyghur political discourse, which is it rests heavily on a conception of history. And so more than I would imagine the average American is, the average Uyghur is very, very conscious of a version of the history of that place and the people called the Uyghurs. And that historical vision then undergirds the notion that the relationship was long colonial, and in fact, it remained colonial after 1949, and on and on.
So then, though, given the fact that say, within Xinjiang, there are a lot of people who might find different sorts of ways to identify themselves with their group, with their family, with the place that they live, and all these ways that people can, then how many people, though, would also think of themselves as Uyghurs in the modern sense that we think of nationality, you know, the way that French people think that they're French or Americans think that they're Americans?
Yes. That's really nicely worded. And I should say that if we look at official population statistics, of a population of about 21 million, there are something over 10 million Uyghurs. And I haven't looked at the most recent figures, and we could have an entire conversation about possible funny business with numbers. But those are official numbers, and you ask me how many people identify, and the straightforward answer is that almost every person, probably every person who is officially identified as a Uyghur also identifies him or herself as Uyghur. And then the next question, of course, is, having identified as Uyghur, does that person also think of him or herself as solely Uyghur, or as a member of a Chinese nation, or as a member of some other group, say, a pan-Turkic nation, something that was much discussed, you know, 80, 90 years ago. So this question of identification, then, is a complicated one, and it's not so simple. We shouldn't think so simply as to say, if there are 10.5 million Uyghurs, that's how many people are a political problem or think a certain way and so forth. And that's why I appreciate the way you worded the question.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Gardner Bovingdon. He is associate professor in the Department of East Asian Languages and Cultures at Indiana University Bloomington, and in his research does work on politics and history of modern Xinjiang, the province in western China where these people that we're talking about, the Uyghurs, live. And he's written about this in his recent book, The Uyghurs, Strangers in Their Own Land, and it's published by the Columbia University Press. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, obviously, to any nation, to any government, sovereignty is an important thing. So that would certainly play into the way that the Chinese government thinks about Xinjiang. But let's talk a little bit more about Xinjiang, this place, and whether, in fact, it also has some strategic significance for Beijing.
It certainly does. And you're right to point out that every state cares about sovereignty, and even states that are critical of Chinese government policies in places like Xinjiang and Tibet are universally themselves in favor of sovereignty of their own and other states. And it's only those states with shall we say, aims to destabilize or weaken other states that will strongly support separatism and strongly challenge the sovereignty of states, so that the episodes in history when a nation seeking independence from a larger state successfully did so. Those episodes are very few, and they have caused a certain amount of chaos and instability in the international system. So that's an important background feature of this place. Also, there is no state on Earth that thinks it has too much territory.
Yeah.
We could just let go of that piece over there and there would be no problem, right? So it isn't odd that the Chinese government maintains that it, of course, can claim Xinjiang as part of its territory. Beijing has very skillfully used the official UN terminology of territorial integrity. This is something not to be challenged by another state. It's important to mention that Xinjiang is actually 1/6 of the total land area of China as it stands. It also has substantial subsurface resources. Of course, there's oil and gas, there's gold, there are other non-ferrous metals, there's uranium. So there are abundant resources. It is also the largest cotton-producing region in China now, and there's a burgeoning industry in cotton production, textile production, and so forth. And then finally, it has a very long land border with Central Asia, and owing to increasingly developed highway and railway infrastructure, it is now an important trade zone with Central Asia. There's a lot of talk in China, and in fact, there's been talk at the other end of this hypothetical bridge about a sort of a new Silk Road linking China with Europe via this land bridge in Xinjiang and Central Asia.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. When we do that, and we'll go to them here, here where we are, Champaign County, it's line number one. Hello.
Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I understand that the tactic that the central government is using to help dilute the discontent among Uyghurs is to send Han to populate the area. And that, of course, doesn't necessarily quell discontent. It probably raises discontent even more. But how do the how does the government recruit migrants to that area? That's my question. I'll listen on the off the air.
All right.
It's a really great question. If I may, in general, agree with the premise of the question, but add a little caveat, it is one of several techniques that the government uses to manage discontent. It is a very important technique. And the answer to the final part of the question is actually quite interesting. From the mid-50s through the late 1970s, that is to say what we call the Mao era, Beijing actually went about officially recruiting and in some cases putting the thumbscrews on people in major urban areas in coastal China to get them to go out and, as the terminology of the time had it, build the borderlands, build Xinjiang, and contribute to the motherland in this way. And tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, ultimately several million Han Chinese moved out there with subventions from the government and, in some cases, promises that they could return after a few years, but ultimately it became clear, and later the government became explicit, that they were really settling in Xinjiang for the long term. Now, with the death of Mao and the arrival of reforms under Deng Xiaoping, the policies changed. It was no longer so practical to try to compel people to move. And so, in fact, in the late 70s and the early 80s, the flow of Han Chinese actually reversed. There was a net outflow of Han Chinese. And from the 80s forward, and actually this accelerated in the 90s and even in the 2000s, the government switched to what we might call more of commercial tactics. It tried to build up the economy in Xinjiang. It elaborated a rail network, ultimately building a rail line down to the fabled city of Kashgar in the southwest from Urumqi. And it also told Han Chinese in the interior that Xinjiang desperately needed talented people to build the economy, and it offered material incentives and so forth. So early on, it all but forced people to move, but from the 80s on, it tried to lure them to move by other tactics. Actually, the net inflow of Han Chinese in the 1990s and the 2000s has been quite striking, so that officially there are some 9 million Han Chinese in Xinjiang now. Remember, I said there was something on the order of 10 plus million Uyghurs. Unofficially, there may be well over 11 million when we include the undocumented migrant workers that are sloshing around all of China, and there are also the summer casual laborers who come in, many of whom go back, but some of whom do not.
So it could well be that within their own land now, the Uyghurs, who were Turkic people, a Turkic ethnic group, they are actually a minority now in their own land and are outnumbered by ethnic Han Chinese.
It could well be. And that's why I flagged earlier the problem of reading statistics.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Just tell us a little bit more about the Uyghurs. What are some of their distinctive features, or at least the things that you would say make them as an ethnic group different from the Han Chinese?
Okay. Straightforwardly, the overwhelming majority of Uyghurs speak Uyghur, which is a Turkic language, most closely related to Uzbek, spoken a couple of states over, but distantly related to the language of Turkish. And indeed, a speaker of any of the Turkic languages could immediately recognize that this is from that language family. Second, and equally important, the overwhelming majority of Uyghurs would readily acknowledge that they are Muslim. Whether they're in fact practicing Muslim and whether they're devout, they would say, yes, I am Muslim by background. Many Uyghurs still maintain some of the sartorial habits, such as hat wearing and wearing certain kinds of jackets and so forth, that can identify them as sort of visibly distinct from Han Chinese. But in urban areas, a substantial number of Uyghurs no longer maintain those signs of dress, those markers that would make them immediately visibly different.
And maybe just also we'd make the point real quickly that there are Uyghurs who live elsewhere in China outside of Xinjiang. In fact, there are Uyghurs who live all over the world. But
yes.
But elsewhere in China, in some of the big cities in China, you will find Uyghur people living.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And indeed, throughout much of Central Asia as well, there are at least 350,000 Uyghurs living in Central Asia, principally in Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, right next door. Hmm.
Another caller here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes, a couple of questions. First, what other minority groups are there in this area? At one time, there were a fairly sizable number of Indo-Iranians, I think, in that area. Is there a remnant of that or not?
Yes, there is. There are people called Tajiks who speak a slightly different Tajik language from that spoken in Tajikistan today. But yes, there are sort of cultural linguistic remnants of that Indo-Iranian population.
The other is, and this is tangential, I'm afraid, but there are a number of non-Han people in China. You think immediately of the Tibetans and the Uyghurs, but there also is a considerable number of Mongolians, and a considerable part of historical Mongolia is now incorporated in China. I guess even the Manchurians are not ethnic Chinese. They're more closely related to the Koreans, I believe, although I believe they came into China through their conquest of China a few centuries ago. But what is the non-Han percentage?
In Xinjiang or in China?
In China.
It's about 8% in all of China, according to official figures.
Quite small, then.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, you referred to the Manchus, and Manchus had really more or less melted into the population, the Han majority population.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because of the tumult of the collapse of the Qing dynasty in 1911. And there was a really extraordinary phenomenon between the 1982 and the 1990 census when more than a million Manchus appeared, seemingly out of nothing. And there was a lot of puzzlement about why this happened. And it turned out that the most probable reason is that the new latitude that Beijing offered non-Han groups to have more children and possibly other perquisites as well suddenly made Manchus realize, oh, well, there's something to be said for being publicly Manchu.
Mm-hmm.
And There are officially 56 groups, as I've already said, of which the Hans are the majority. Some of the groups maintain differences of dress and language that make them immediately identifiable. There are many groups among those 56 who are not visibly or in most of the ways we would normally think of distinguishable from Han Chinese. And so it's often a challenge to figure out what constitutes a significant ethnic difference and so forth.
If China were to recover Taiwan, that would actually introduce another linguistic and ethnic minority, wouldn't it? Because the Formosans are not Chinese at all.
Well, that's an entire different can of worms, because, in fact, what you're calling, there's a controversy even on the island of Taiwan about what a Formosan is, but there's an immediate point to make, which is that the Taiwanese language is not the same as Mandarin. It is important to recognize that that same Taiwanese language is called Minnan, and it's spoken in southern Fujian province right across the water. But another thing to add is that Taiwan has its own unassimilated cultural minorities. So, in fact, there, hypothetically, one would be adding multiple groups distinct from the Han Chinese.
I need to jump in here just to remind people that we're already at our midpoint. I want to thank the caller and invite some others. We're talking here in this hour of Focus with Gardner Bovingdon. He is associate professor in East Asian Languages and Cultures at Indiana University, Bloomington, and his research focuses on politics and history of modern Xinjiang, the province in western China that is the home to the Uyghurs. People we're talking about here, something that he deals with in his recent book, The Uyghurs, Strangers in Their Own Land. It's published by the Columbia University Press. Certainly you could find it in the bookstore if you'd like to read up on the subject. And questions, comments, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. You mentioned that one of the things, one of the perhaps distinct features of the people that we're talking about is that they are Muslim.
Yes.
What's the attitude of the Chinese government toward the practice of the Muslim faith, and what sort of things has the government either done, tried to foster it or tried to discourage it, or is their position more neutral?
It's a really important question, and there's a general answer and there's a more specific answer. The general answer is that the Chinese constitution officially guarantees a freedom of religious belief to all peoples in China. And other official documents recognize that many of the non-Han groups in China are not only culturally and linguistically distinct, but they're distinguished by their religious faiths. So formally, any practitioner of any world religion in China has a freedom of religious belief. When you look at practicing Muslims in other part of China, for instance, the so-called Hui Muslims, who are Chinese-speaking and Chinese-looking, to put it crudely, Muslims, you find actually wide latitude to build mosques, practice Islam, even introduce Islamic teachings to children and so forth. Out in Xinjiang, particularly since the 90s, the regulation of Islam has been a good deal more rigorous. I should go back and say that a freedom of religious belief is explicitly not the same thing as freedom of religious practice. So the Constitution secures the freedom to believe. It does not secure the freedom to practice a religion as one sees fit. And in Xinjiang, the term of art is legal and illegal religious activity. And the state has always been somewhat vague about what constitutes illegal religious activity, state actors often identify threatening behaviors as illegal religious activity. So since the 1990s, and particularly since an event I talk about in my book, an uprising in southwest Xinjiang in April of 1990, the government has very closely regulated the construction and maintenance of mosques. It has closed down mosques that it does not recognize legally. It's been very, very cautious about allowing mullahs and other religious leaders to be trained. And in fact, in the aftermath of that 1990 uprising, the government took it upon itself to dismiss a large number of clerics that it judged unfit for their jobs. It's insisted that clerics undergo regular education in what's called patriotic education, and it's insisted that any Muslim cleric must be patriotic to China to be a good Muslim, and it's insisted that those clerics in turn insert that message into their sermons. Particularly in the late 90s and the 2000s, the government has put close scrutiny to two groups. Party members have been forbidden to believe in Islam or to show any obvious signs of Islamic faith, and students have been forbidden to practice or believe. And so students, until the age of 18, are forbidden to enter a mosque. They're forbidden to enter into private religious study. If they're caught doing private religious study, the adults that are teaching them can be punished. They're forbidden to go to mosque schools, private schools with any sort of religious content. Official schools are forbidden to allow any religious content into the classroom. Students are forbidden from praying. They're forbidden from fasting during Ramadan. And this extends, even though it's formally till the age of 18, college students also come under this rubric. And so college students are forbidden to enter a mosque, join a religious group, be caught praying, be caught fasting, be caught practicing their religion. So the regulation of Islam and Islamic practice among Uyghurs in Xinjiang is extremely rigorous, and this is one of the many complaints Uyghurs have. And when I said earlier that Uyghurs in general feel they don't have autonomy, this is one of the obvious manifestations. Many secular Uyghurs I've known have said, I myself do not wish to practice regularly, and I don't wish to have religion be a huge influence on my life. At the same time, I dearly believe that every other person has the freedom to practice and believe, and I'm not happy that the government closes mosques and tells Uyghur children they not, may not study religion and so forth.
Yeah. So I think it's really it's interesting to set side by side the experiences of the Uyghurs and the Hui and the differences between them, because it seems that the Hui, even though they're not Han Chinese, they speak Chinese, and culturally they're more similar, certainly more similar to the Han than they are to the Uyghurs. And doesn't the sorts of issues, the kinds of nationalism that we see in the Uyghurs, you just don't really see that with the Hui. They seem to be much to have assimilated more easily or more fully, certainly, than the Uyghurs have. And it sort of makes you wonder, well, what exactly is the difference? Does it really come down to the fact that they speak Chinese and that culturally they're a little bit more like the Han? Well, they're certainly more like the Han than the Uyghurs are.
Well, several of my colleagues, Drew Gladney and Jonathan Lippman, have done excellent work to show how challenging it is to figure out exactly what makes Hui Hui. Mm-hmm. And Drew Gladney has gone so far as to suggest that what really makes Hui Hui is their identification as such by the government. He did field work around the country and found that Hui communities differed among themselves so substantially. Some practiced Islam, others didn't. Some eschewed pork, some didn't. Some spoke local languages. There are Hui in the Tibetan region who speak Tibetan as their first language and so forth. That there were really no common features other than the fact that they were identified as Hui. And he actually came to the conclusion that over time it was the state identification that gave all Hui a common sense of belonging to this group. But you're absolutely right. There has never been, at least not to my knowledge, a Hui separatist movement. There has never been, since 1949, a political cause to establish an independent Hui state. And so that is a signal difference.
I want to get to make sure that we talk about resistance among the Uyghurs to Chinese, I guess they would say Chinese rule. And again, here, this is one of the things that has, if anything, has brought the existence of the Uyghurs to people's attention. It's coverage of this, and particularly, I'm sure people will remember, there was a particularly bad outbreak of violence in the summer of 2009, where, as far as China is concerned, officially something close to 200 people died. And I think if you ask the Uyghurs, they'd say, well, there were more than that. Yep. And a lot of people were arrested, and it was particularly intense, although it's not the first time something like this has happened. And you talk in the book about a couple of levels of resistance. You talk about everyday resistance, and then you talk about collective action and violence. In what ways do the people there in Xinjiang engage in, maybe just ask as far as everyday resistance is concerned, well, what does that mean?
Well, it's a good question. Going back to the beginning of our conversation, we agreed that few people had heard of the Uyghurs before 2001, and one reason was that they didn't really appear in the paper much. One of the places they would have appeared in the Western press before 2001 was in 1997, when there was a major uprising in Liljiao or Yili in northwest Xinjiang, but that was an episode of collective action. And mostly over the years, the press has paid attention to that sort of thing. Actually, in the last few years, various journalists have gotten much more interested in what I call in the book everyday resistance. So the point that I make in the book is that the Chinese government is extremely wary of any form of public protest or dissent from any group, so that when peasants or urban workers stage major protests inside China, frequently the police will smash the protest and throw the organizers in jail and so forth, because it's very concerned not to have social movements link up and threaten the power of the party. When it comes to Xinjiang, there's an added concern that if Uyghurs go out in the street and demonstrate publicly, that other Uyghurs are going to see them doing so, and that movement is going to snowball and create a real problem. Because the government is so concerned, there are especially rigorous regulations for political activity in Xinjiang, and Uyghurs live in fear of being at least stigmatized and possibly given labels that prevent them from finding good housing or getting job promotions and so forth. Worse yet, potentially getting thrown in jail for a while. We're still getting thrown in prison for a long time and even ultimately executed for political crimes. As a consequence, many Uyghurs who are dissatisfied and who know that it would be very costly to engage in major overt protest find small ways to do so. They'll write or read dissident poetry. They'll sing or listen to dissident songs. They'll tell jokes that mock Chinese authority and so forth. They'll have sort of sotto voce conversations among themselves about how bad things are and how much better they could be if the circumstances were different and so forth. So in a variety of ways, individuals and small groups find avenues for expressing their discontent and expressing political longings and so forth in ways that they have reason to hope will not be punished.
You in the book actually have a kind of an afterword, a little section that essentially the book was finished, and you explain the fact that just as it was going to print, that was when this violence was going on in July 2009, and I think it was something you felt you had to say something about here, or at least to talk about what you thought this was all about. And there may indeed be confusion, or at least I'm sure, as far as the Uyghurs are concerned and Beijing is concerned, different ways of explaining what this was all about. What was this all about?
Well, if I may, let me back up first and say that an argument that I'd made in a previous chapter, the one about collective resistance, made me skeptical that there would be such violent and overt action in Xinjiang again after 2001. And in short, the argument was that episodes of protest, despite Beijing's extreme wariness of public protests I've already mentioned, episodes of protest in China proper had been going up year on year through the 90s and indeed through the 2000s. And the Chinese actually released statistics to this effect. And when I carefully compiled statistics of my own on protest in Xinjiang, though the number was much smaller, so there's a problem of comparability, what I found was that episodes of protest were becoming rarer in Xinjiang in the late 90s and, from 2000 on. So while protest was increasing in China as a whole, it was decreasing in Xinjiang. And I concluded that since there was abundant evidence that of widespread Uyghur discontent, we couldn't attribute this decreased public protest to increasing Uyghur satisfaction. Right. Instead, we had to think about the role of repression and various state strategies for reducing it. So when, in summer of 2009, thousands of Uyghurs marched in the streets protesting, and at the end of that day, July 5th, 2009, there was widespread violence, this was really quite shocking. I was personally shocked. I'd already gone on record saying that such a thing would not happen again. What was it about? Nominally, it was about expressing dissatisfaction with Chinese policies. In particular, the protesters were unhappy about an event that had happened on June 25th of the same year when Uyghurs in a factory down in Guangdong China's major export platform, were set upon violently by Han workers at the same factory. And several were killed and a large number were injured. And this violence, in turn, was reputed to have stemmed from a rumor that Uyghur men had raped two Chinese women, a rumor that was later officially revealed to be groundless. And I think this probably was the case, that there was no substance to the rumor. And what Uyghurs were dissatisfied with when they protested on July 5th was that Hans had not been punished for the death of those two Uyghur men killed in the violence in Guangdong or for the injuries of many others. And so one of the official slogans they raised was, the government needs to punish wrongdoers. It needs to protect Uyghurs and so forth. Since I wasn't there, I don't know whether the slogans they raised, but I've already described the rigor with which Uyghur Islam is regulated. I'm sure that there were people in that crowd who were dissatisfied with that. The big problem, once we've established that there was a protest that had a large number of people involved and that its proximal cause was local dissatisfaction with the handling of that, the riot and the deaths down in Guangdong, the next problem is figuring out, was this a peaceful protest that police tried to crush and in violently responding then precipitated violent response from the Uyghur protesters? Or was this, as Beijing maintains, a protest whose organizers also planned to enact violence by the end of the night? And you've already mentioned the official 200 dead from that day, and the story, best as we can reconstruct it, is that Uyghurs went through the streets and actually stabbed or otherwise mortally wounded a number of Han Chinese. We don't know the circumstances. I'm not sure we'll ever fully know the circumstances. It's hard to get a full story out. And you, I think, rightly suggested that Uyghurs believe widely that there were more casualties because, of course, the police went around shooting people through the night, and I've spoken with people who in turn said they've spoken to eyewitnesses. So I want to be clear that I did not see this, and the person I spoke to did not see it, but they said that eyewitnesses had seen plenty of people shot in the back, meaning that they were running away from any violence, and they were still shot. So I've offered some proximal cause for the event. I've talked about some of the other possible dissatisfactions, and I've talked about the problem of establishing the course of events that led beyond doubt to violence and a large number of deaths by the end of the evening, and which a lot of people now, in retrospect, regard as an episode of ethnic violence, as ethnic rioting. Uyghur on Han rioting.
About 5-6 minutes left. Our guest Gardner Bovingdon is here from Indiana University Bloomington. There is so much I'm sure we could continue for a long time. Let me just introduce one other sort of question, and at least you can talk about it for a couple of minutes. The Chinese government said, well, pointing to what happened back in July of 2009, said, well, this was a lot of this was the work of Uyghurs living outside of the United States, outside the classic outside agitators, people who are causing trouble, and particularly the Chinese wanted to blame a woman named Rabia Kadir, who is a very important Uyghur nationalist leader, who actually lives in the United States. She's in exile, and said, well, she and her people were sort of behind this. How influential is the Uyghur diaspora, and how involved are they in actually what happens back in Xinjiang?
Yeah, it's a very good question. There's no doubt that Rabia Khanim, her name in Uyghur is pronounced Rabia Qadir. An unfortunate side effect of the way that Uyghur names are transcribed into Chinese and then brought into English, that people know her as Kadir. In any case, there's no question that she is highly regarded and highly influential among the Uyghur diaspora. She is the leader of the umbrella movement that governs Uyghurs in diaspora. She frequently travels and gives speeches, and she comments on important issues of the day. So there's no question that she's influential outside Xinjiang. It's very hard to establish how much influence she has inside. It's very clear that Beijing wishes that she had no influence at all and does all that it can to prevent things that she says, places that she goes, things that happened to her from filtering into China. So, for instance, when she was twice nominated for the Nobel Prize, Beijing did everything it could to make sure that that news did not filter into Xinjiang. The interesting thing is, as I argue in the book, the Chinese government has an explanation problem when it comes to episodes of Uyghur protest. Can one person, however influential, however inspiring, really be credited with sending that many people into the street? I'm highly dubious. And my argument is, however influential this person is, that's not a complete explanation. We need to look at local dissatisfaction and so forth. And so I know I'm being long-winded about this, but however influential Rabia Khanom is and Uyghur organizations are abroad, if they were simply spouting pie in the sky about what ought to happen in Xinjiang and there were no local resonance, then they would have exactly no capacity to mobilize local protesters. And so a large proportion of the explanation for that local protest has to stem from how Uyghurs feel locally and what their lives are like there.
Now, finally, I guess we have to ask the question about what lies ahead. And again, I know that this is complicated and we have, you know, about 2 minutes or two, 3 minutes. Whether it's likely that there will be some kind of resolution here that would certainly satisfy the Uyghurs, who, you know, if not, would expect true independence, a greater level of autonomy. You know, it's all well and good that it's called the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, as you point out, but the fact of the matter is that the Uyghurs aren't ruling. The Chinese are. What possibility is there for at least maybe greater autonomy, if not something more?
Yeah, and this I can say concisely. The principal problem here is that even if we don't know how many Uyghurs want independence, we know that a lot of Uyghurs are dissatisfied. And at minimum, what they want is greater autonomy. They want greater religious freedom. They want greater freedom to speak out and to organize politically and so forth. What Beijing wants is for them to have less of those things. So Beijing and Uyghurs in general are at cross purposes about how to solve this problem. Hardliners are still dominant in Beijing, and their answer is clamp down, increase Han immigration to the extent possible, but then with the added notion that the carrot of economic growth is going to resolve these problems. Maybe Uyghurs will not be satisfied politically, but over time, economically, they'll come to be more satisfied. So the government is actually flooding resources into Xinjiang to try to stimulate more economic growth in the hopes that maybe this will satisfy many people who've previously been dissatisfied. I think, actually, there is likely to be economic growth. It's not likely to satisfy Uyghurs' political aspirations. And so I think there's going to be continued tension.
And continued, perhaps, complications involved with the concerns about militant Islam other places around the world. As you said, what the Chinese have done is that they've used this. I suppose it's maybe not unlike the way the Russians have talked about the Chechens and have said to the rest of the world, well, you know, you have your terrorists and we have ours, and if you don't bother us about how we deal with ours, we won't bother you about how you deal with yours.
Yeah.
And so the Chinese have essentially played that same sort of game as far as Xinjiang is concerned.
Yeah.
Is that likely to change?
No. I would add that you're right to make an analogy with the Russians. The problem being that there are actually Chechen organizations, and there has long been an armed resistance movement in Chechnya, much to the Russian government's dismay. Militant Islam is essentially not a problem in Xinjiang. I know that it's pretty stark to put it that way, but if there are militant Muslims, they're vanishingly small in number, and they wield almost no influence in Xinjiang. Right? So China can talk till it's blue in the face about that problem, but it's really pointing away from the crux of the problem, which is that there are a very large number of Uyghurs who are dissatisfied and don't have avenues of legitimate expression of grievances, and they don't have sort of political mechanisms to turn those grievances into policy proposals and actually affect policy. So I think in that way, we're really quite stuck.
Yeah. And though at the very least, I suppose you can say that now more people know who the Uyghurs are, although perhaps they don't really know what they should. And I'm guessing that probably there, people can go out and they can read your book, but I don't imagine there are a lot of resources out there now for people who are interested in trying to find out about Xinjiang?
Well, let me just suggest a wonderful book which is aware of the political issues in Xinjiang, but is mostly preoccupied with the question of who are Uyghurs and what do they do? And it's a book called Down a Narrow Road by my colleague Jay Doucher. And this is a truly marvelous book to answer that question. So I highly recommend it to listeners.
And you, it sounds as if you've, you know, you've spent time there. You've certainly, I'm sure, talked with Uyghurs, as many Uyghur people as you have the opportunity to, and have traveled in Xinjiang. But talking to people there and traveling there sounds like it's not an easy thing.
Well, it's especially not easy for me since I've been banned from China since 2004.
Oh. I see. Well, even at the time, it sounds though, even at the time that it would, for anybody, it would be a difficult thing if you're really trying to talk to people about politics and find people who are actually willing to tell you what they think.
Yes, it's extremely difficult, and I know many people who are still going, still trying to go, and some people manage, but they've reported back that the circumstances for doing research and the general sort of political pull makes it extremely difficult to get people to reveal their true thoughts and so forth. It's extremely dicey right now.
Yeah. And does it, you know, again, you want to draw analogies, say, between Xinjiang and Tibet, and that fortunately the people of Tibet have a remarkable representative in the person of the Dalai Lama, but also there's a lot of interest in Tibet and has been going back, well, some time. Whether that helps Tibet or not, maybe that's another question.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really seem that, with the possible exception of the person that we mentioned, that there aren't quite as many people in the Uyghurs' corner as there are people who are advocating for Tibet.
Yes, I think that's right. As I've mentioned already, I think Rabia has done remarkable work to publicize the condition of the Uyghurs and to speak in various venues about the situation. As we've talked about already, I think it's an unfortunate accident of history that in the period in which she emerged as the paramount leader, Islam is sort of under a cloud in the non-Muslim world. There's a sort of a general suspicion of Muslims, and so she's had a hard job to suggest that, well, yes, in fact, Uyghurs are Muslims, and they have this historical association, but they are not the Muslims that people think of when they think of violent terrorist activity and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she's right to make that argument.
Our guest, Gardner Bovingdon, Associate Professor of East Asian Languages and Cultures, Indiana University, Bloomington. His book is The Uyghurs, Strangers in Their Own Land, published by the Columbia University Press. And Professor Bovingdon, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.